from WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Extreme heat in Europe and the continental U.S. has made headlines this summer. What you may not have heard about is what's been going on in Alaska. 90-degree temperatures in the Arctic, wildfires and rare lightning storms, and the ground literally collapsing due to the melting of permafrost. A team of scientists and students with the Woods Hole Research Center's Polaris Project are just back from a trip to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta to study climate impacts. And lead scientist Sue Natale joins me now to share what they saw and experienced and what it means for the entire globe. Sue, welcome back to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you, Heather. Thank you for having me.
You have been doing work in the Alaskan Arctic for several years. What made this year different in terms of the changes that you were seeing in the Arctic, in the ecosystems where you work?
There were a number of extreme changes that I saw this year that I hadn't ever experienced before. One was just the temperature was quite extreme. So we hit days of 90 degrees Fahrenheit, which I had never experienced before.
I mean, that's hot here, but to be in the Alaskan Arctic and it's 90 degrees.
Yeah, that's extremely hot. I mean, as a scientist, it's really challenging to work because you're wearing long pants and field boots and, you know, carrying heavy packs. There's no AC. You know, we're living out in tents. And so your tent is just boiling at night when you get back in it. And, you know, what I remind myself is that we're just there for a few weeks or just there for the summer. And there are people who are living this extreme temperature all the time. And so it was really a challenge. The other thing that was challenging about this summer was the air quality was extremely poor. I did notice that there seemed to be a lot more allergens was one thing, just pollen from plants. But what was even worse was the fire and the smoke. We were surrounded by smoke, and there were several days where between 90 degrees Fahrenheit and being surrounded by smoke, it was really, really hard to walk very far. It was hard just to, there was nowhere to get away from the smoke. The other thing that was unusual about this year is we had lightning storms. That's not that common in the tundra. It's actually not something when we sort of do our safety preparations, it actually hasn't been something that we've focused on, but we had several days of lightning storms. And, you know, imagine being in the tundra where there's no trees and there's no buildings. You are the highest item on the landscape. So that's also a safety concern. In addition to the warm air temperatures, soil temperatures were really warm. So we installed temperature sensors down to a meter in what was permafrost or should be permafrost. In 2017, the temperature was minus 0.6 degrees Celsius, which is just about thawing. Last year it was minus 0.3, and this year it was minus 0.1.
So we talk about extremes here of temperatures when we're talking about warmth, right? 90 degrees for the air, that sounds warm. What you're talking about here are still freezing temperatures.
Yeah, it's still freezing, but when you're at that point of freezing, so the ground stays frozen. The permafrost is ground that stays frozen, and it occurs across large areas of the Arctic. When you go from frozen state to thawed state, another extreme thing we saw was pretty substantial ground collapse. And I have never seen the level of ground collapse that I saw this year in 1 year's time before, ever.
So, I mean, what do you mean by ground collapse?
So the surface of the ground thaws and refreezes annually. Underneath that is permafrost. So this is just ground that stays frozen. It also contains ice. So when the ice melts, it turns to water. Water has less of a volume than ice, a smaller volume, and it also can run away. So this permafrost that's basically creating this hard ground, once it thaws, the ground can literally collapse. And so we've had places where, say, we set up a transect last year, and now 10 meters of that transect is gone. The ground kind of has just fallen into a wetland or fallen into a lake. There were areas where the ground was opening up. You can see the roots of plants just being pulled by the ground opening up, and you could stand, you know, a meter down into the ground. And there's a lot of things concerning about that. I mean, you can imagine if you had a house built on this.
Obviously,
there's a lot of communities in Alaska are having to deal with this, and that's a problem. A lot of the focus of my work is on carbon emissions from thawing permafrost. So you have this ground that was frozen that, one, is supporting the ground surface, but it also stored a lot of carbon. It just was frozen in the ground, frozen organic material. And there's this gradual thawing. But all of a sudden, when this ground cracks and opens up, you have the ground going from just having, say, the top 50 centimeters be thawed. Now it's thawed down to a meter and a half. And you can see, you can just see the entire soil profile. You can stand in this crack and just see the ground opening up.
Hmm. Sue Natale, you're there to study climate change, as you said, in part studying how, as the permafrost starts to thaw, how that might affect how much carbon is released into the atmosphere. What about this year? I mean, is this just one bad year, one extreme year, or does this to you scream out this is climate change and that it's accelerating?
It's definitely climate change and it's accelerating. And the past couple years have been particularly bad. The past winters have been warm. There's been rain when there should be snow. The ground hasn't been frozen. In this area, the surface of the ground didn't freeze until mid-January this year. Hmm. And so then you have that lag of that frozen ground. It was warmer, and then that goes into the summer, and that's why you're resulting in this ground cracking. It definitely is accelerating. And the problem is, once you have an abrupt event like this, the ground cracks and opens up. It's not something that can just be undone by a cold year, because you've already sort of exposed all this ground. Some of the material is just falling into lakes. Like, you're losing ground material, and you just can't go back in a human relevant time frame.
One of the things, as we said, you're studying is what happens to that carbon as the ground melts, as it's exposed and kind of crumbling like this. What are you learning about that? I mean, what is the scope or the scale of the potential release of carbon as this happens?
The location where I just came from is in southwest Alaska. It's in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and it's in a tundra region. It's filled with wetlands. So one of the things we've been focusing on is sort of the effects of permafrost thaw, but also the effects of fire, because there's, even though it's wetland, surprisingly, there are fires that happen. And this combination of fire and these warming temperatures is a bad combination
double
in terms
whammy
of carbon emissions, for sure. I mean, we've seen, you know, twice the amount of ground thaw, say, even outside of these areas that are cracking. So last year in the burned areas in July, the ground that was thawed was about 50 centimeters deep, and then you get to frozen soil. This year it was more than a meter in many areas. I've never, ever seen a change like that from one year to the next, ever. We're seeing areas that burned, wetland areas that are maybe not directly impacted by the fire, but downslope from the fire, higher methane emissions from some of these areas, because you're getting materials that are running off from the area that burned. Some of these slumping areas are providing a source of material for microbes in water bodies. So we're seeing higher methane emissions from areas where the ground is collapsing. One thing that one of the students that was with our group measured this year was nitrous oxide concentrations in soils that were quite high, much higher than atmospheric. And this is something we hadn't measured in past years. In undisturbed tundra, we have never seen nitrous oxide emissions. So nitrous oxide is another greenhouse gas. It's more than 100 times more potent than carbon Wow. dioxide. And so these are new observations.
Obviously, a lot we still don't know.
There's a lot we don't know. And these abrupt changes are the type of things that concern me, because, you know, when we try to model how permafrost will thaw and how much carbon emissions will come out from permafrost thaw, it's these sort of abrupt events that are really tricky to get into the models. And so when this is modeled, it's this gradual top-down thawing and this gradual release. But then you have an abrupt event where the ground cracks open. You have this huge area that's thawed that we didn't expect to thaw. And then that all dumps into a lake, which is a nice environment for methane production. And all of a sudden,
bacteria.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, you have this source of carbon that just was dumped into it, a source of nutrients that was just dumped into it. And these are these processes that it's not that scientists don't know that they can happen. I think they're just happening at a faster rate, and they're just also hard to put into a model.
And so they're not, it sounds like, being really accounted for when we're thinking about, you know, how much carbon is in the atmosphere now, how much carbon is likely to be in the atmosphere in 5, 10, 50 years.
These abrupt events are definitely, they're definitely not accounted for. I mean, just even carbon emissions from permafrost are generally not accounted for into, so the last models, global climate models that informed our sort of international community in terms of decision-making about reducing fossil fuel emissions. So the IPCC reports, the permafrost carbon emissions didn't go into that accounting. We're working to put it into the models, but that's, we haven't even begun to really put in all of these processes, these abrupt events, the interaction of fire and what fire does to permafrost thaw. I would say we're being quite conservative when we make our estimates about how much carbon will be released from thawing permafrost because of these sort of surprising events.
And what are those estimates right now? I mean, how does what's going on in the Arctic compare to all of the fossil fuel burning that's going on around the world?
Yeah, so there's some range in the estimates, but about estimated about 150 billion tons of carbon will be released from thawing permafrost by the end of the century if we continue to emit fossil fuel emissions at our current rate. So to put that...
What
does that mean? 150 billion tons, it sounds like a lot, and it is a lot. U.S. emissions right now are about 1.5 billion tons per year. So if we think about
that... 100 years worth of U.S. emissions.
Yeah, if we think about it, though, it's another fossil fuel emitting country, right? So by the end of the century, 150 billion from thawing permafrost, that's on par with the U.S. emission rate. And this is something we're not accounting for. You know, U.S. is the second largest fossil fuel emitter. We would never not account for the U.S. emissions in our budgeting. And so I think it's, you know, our ability to keep our global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius is dependent upon accounting for all of the sources of carbon that we can expect to go into the atmosphere.
Well, it's not just reliant on us accounting for them. It's reliant on us also controlling them. And this is a source that we can't really control. We can't turn off the tap. We don't have a way of just saying to the permafrost, all right, time to stop thawing and stop emitting now.
Well, by, you know, because carbon dioxide, methane are global greenhouse gases, emissions that we reduce in all parts of the world will also reduce carbon that comes out of permafrost, right? So as we keep our global temperatures down, that means less permafrost will thaw. As less permafrost thaws, then more of the carbon will stay locked away in the permafrost.
That's one way that the cycle could go, right? But that's the virtuous cycle, I guess, that if we control warming from fossil fuels, we can control the release from permafrost thawing, but that can work in the opposite direction as well, right? That the more warming there is, the more carbon dioxide there is released, the more warming there is. I mean, it just kind of keeps going.
Yeah, it does keep going. But it's not, you know, some permafrost has already thawed and some will continue to thaw. And so it's not a hopeless case, right? Like there's nothing we can do because the permafrost carbon has thawed and some carbon is being released. You know, keeping at our current rate of fossil fuel emissions, we may lose 70% of permafrost, but greatly reducing it, we may only thaw 30%. And that's a big difference. That's a huge range. It means a lot to the people who are living in the permafrost region, whose homes are in the permafrost region. Some people are already being impacted and will continue to be impacted, but I think sort of the urgency of reducing fossil fuel emissions will certainly make a difference. Acting now will make a huge difference from acting in 10 years, in 20 years, or in 30 years.
How do you personally deal with what must be a psychological and an emotional burden coming from the knowledge that you have of what's going on? You're seeing how ecosystems and communities are being affected. You understand how what's going on in the Arctic could affect all of us by releasing all of these greenhouse gases. I mean, how do you kind of cope with all of that?
Sometimes it's challenging. I think the thing that helps me to cope with it is I know that knowing is better than not knowing, right? You know, I mean, even with a disease, you may not want to hear that you have something wrong with you, but you're a lot better off because then you can start figuring out a solution. And so I don't like the news, and it's not good news, but being ignorant of the news isn't going to help at all, right? So having the knowledge that I do, at least I can talk to people about it. At least I can try to talk with policymakers. At least I can try to sort of push to have, you know, the handle turn so we can reduce our fossil fuel emissions and to increase that urgency, it would still be happening if I knew nothing. And I don't think I would be any better off.
That's Sue Natale of Woods Hole Research Center. Sue, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Heather.
Up next, it's not just cars and power plants. Every little thing we buy or use has an environmental impact. Living Lab Radio continues after the break. You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We've all heard of conspicuous consumption. Big fancy houses, big fancy cars, designer clothes, and luxurious vacations. That kind of lifestyle comes with a big price tag and a big carbon footprint. But here's the thing. We are all consumers, and the things we buy and do can rack up quite a carbon footprint even if they're not conspicuous. Everyday choices, like the food we buy and the clothes we wear, have environmental impacts that we often underestimate or ignore altogether. Tatiana Schlossberg shines a light on those issues in her new book, Inconspicuous Consumption. She's a former science writer for the New York Times, and she joins me now. Tatiana, good to talk with you.
Hi, it's so great to be here. Thank you.
Can you just give us your definition of inconspicuous consumption?
Sure. So in the way that I write about it in the book, you know, it's the hidden and unconscious environmental impacts of all of our stuff. The consumption that we do all the time that we don't think about, things we take for granted or think of as necessities, but, you know, they're all kind of connected to global climate change or environmental pollution and degradation and in ways that we don't think about and in ways that kind of connect us all through the different impacts that they have.
We tend to think about or hear about things like the cars that we drive, the electricity that we use, those kind of big ticket carbon footprint items.
Yeah.
How does all of the other consumption, the inconspicuous consumption, compare to those parts of our carbon footprint?
So those things are definitely big and important parts of, you know, our carbon footprint as individuals and as society. But as you say, you know, those are the things that maybe we know about. One of the chapters in my book is about the internet and technology, talking about how much electricity it takes to use the internet. And, you know, for each one of us, it might be small, but we use the internet so much and so much more than we used to and for lots of different things. And that adds up. And I also think it's really easy to overlook because it's invisible to each one of us because we don't have a server farm in our house. So
not all of us anyway.
Right. And, you know, and then I wrote about fashion and denim. You know, producing cotton for denim uses a tremendous amount of water, but also, you know, all the different baths to dye the denim uses a lot. And, you know, what happens? We're buying clothes that we think of as disposable, and so we throw them away, and that produces landfill emissions. Or when we put our clothing in the washing machine, if it's synthetic fibers, that might result in microplastic pollution from the, you know, little pieces of polyester that break off and are too small to be trapped by our washing machine. So we would never think about them, and it's not necessarily like the fault of the individual or the consumer for not thinking about them, because it's not obvious and we're not told about it, and it's really hard to find this stuff out. And so that's why I wanted to write this book, because I was curious and I felt like other people might have these questions. And once I started digging into it, it was, well, of course we have these questions because this information really isn't available to the average person.
Well, let's walk through a few of those, because in the book, Inconspicuous Consumption, there are three or four big sections. And as you mentioned, food is one of those, fashion is one of those. And to the point you were just making about how hard it can be to figure this out, you say the fashion industry is particularly bad when it comes to transparency and providing information to consumers and even to journalists like yourself trying to figure out what's going on. What makes the fashion industry so different?
I have some pet theories, but, you know, I think one of them is that it's not something that historically has been seen as especially serious. So, you know, it hasn't necessarily been subject to the same kind of scientific inquiry as some of these other areas. And it also happens, manufacturing and production happens in places without good environmental standards, like Bangladesh or Vietnam and China. That's very removed from us. But, you know, it's also an industry that touches so many other industries. It's, you know, it's agriculture and livestock and petrochemicals and manufacturing and advertising. And, you know, so it's sort of touches so many different things. And so it's hard to kind of pull out the discrete elements. And so for fashion in particular, I had to sort of pick a few things that I wanted to write about and, you know, in order to kind of convey what's going on in the industry and the magnitude of it, as opposed to kind of top to bottom, here's how it all works.
I know that your point in writing this book was not necessarily to give people an easy, you know, do this or do that answer. But one thing with regard to clothing and environmental impact, a question that I've had many times and have found it hard to answer, is if you were to weigh the environmental impact of natural fiber clothing, something like denim, something based from cotton where you have, you know, land use and water and fertilizer being used to create the cotton, versus synthetic clothes where it might be petroleum based and you're essentially creating a plastic product. In all of your investigation, how do those end up balancing out in terms of environmental footprint? Is it possible to do that kind of comparison?
I try to resist the temptation to say one thing is better than the other, because, as you say, they are so different in their kind of different impacts. And they are actually pretty linked together. Like, unless you're buying something that's 100% cotton, it will probably be like a cotton poly blend. So, you know, it's all there. It's all kind of intertwined. I think, you know, there are some fibers that are more sustainable just because of, you know, the nature of them, which are like linen and flax and hemp. But those are sort of very small sectors of the market and harder to come by. But yes, as you're saying, you know, I don't want to say here's what to do, here's what not to do, and that this is a problem that can be fixed by individuals. But at the same time, to really think about, what do you need? Like, do we really all need to have everything we want all the time? And maybe to think about, you know, keeping our clothes for longer, or trying to fix them, or, you know, not buying something just because we can.
Tatiana Schlossberg, another section of Inconspicuous Consumption, your book, is dedicated to food. And there, it's maybe not, you know, just saying reduce is maybe not the solution. We all have to eat, but there are decisions that we make about what we buy.
Yes.
And we might, you know, if we're thinking, okay, carbon footprint, maybe we're thinking about how far away something came from. But you actually raise an interesting question about organic food.
Yes.
And how, you literally posed the question, how good is organic? What did you find out about organic food that would cause you to pose that question?
There are a couple of things. You know, one of them is, what do we actually mean by organic? And I think in our ideal imagination, it's like a small family farm. And that's not really always what it is. The way that I got interested in it was that I had found this apple orchard in Connecticut. It's called Rogers Orchards, and they're the best apples that I've ever had. And I really love apples, so this is a particularly high standard. And so they wrote to me, and they said that after I ordered some apples online, you know, referring to my own carbon footprint is not exactly pristine, but, you know, saying that they were not organic, but they were committed to sustainability and sort of, you know, the highest levels of environmental integrity. And so I was really curious, you know, well, here are some people who care about the environment and who it really matters for their product, you know, how things are grown and how they take care of the land and the soil. And so why wouldn't they be organic? And, you know, what I found out from them was that in New England, it's really hard to grow an apple using only organic practices because of the mildew and the pest pressure. But as I looked into it more, I also found that to feed the whole world organically, we would have to clear a lot of land that's forested or, you know, other kind of natural ecosystems, because you don't get as much yield per acre.
Well, Tatiana Schlossberg, as you've already alluded to, a lot of the things that we buy and use and consume at this point come from far away. And you also spend a good chunk of your book, Inconspicuous Consumption, on the carbon footprint and the environmental impact more broadly of shipping. And you use this one example that stood out to me. I mean, it afforded you the opportunity to play with some puns, which was fun. but you use the example of something as small and simple as a red rose given as a Valentine gift, and the hidden footprint, largely of the shipping, but of just that one simple item. Give us that story.
So the red rose, that's air cargo just because it's so perishable. But because of, you know, various trade agreements, most of the roses and lots of the other flowers that we sell and buy in the U.S. come from South America and Colombia in particular. And so when you're buying a rose, you know, if it's at a corner store or Walmart, which I think is, you know, one of the largest sellers of flowers in the country, you may not think about where it comes from, or you assume that it's not from not that far away or a greenhouse or something, but it's most likely coming from Colombia. And so, you know, we're not thinking about the backstories of all the things that we buy and where they come from. And a flower might seem like, yeah, it doesn't take a ton of gasoline to move a flower, but sort of the cumulative impact of, you know, how we've decided to structure our economy and the way that we buy things around the ease of moving goods. And that's especially true of shipping, as you mentioned, which is, you know, we hear arguments like, well, it's cheaper to manufacture something in China and ship it to the U.S. And it's cheaper because nobody's paying for the pollution.
Right. And by the time I encountered your story of the single red rose fairly late mm-hmm. in the book, it was no longer just about right. the rose. I'm thinking, oh, you know, the rose was wrapped in a piece of plastic and it was shipped from somewhere and it was kept cold. And it really drives home the point that these things that we take for granted as, you know, as the title of your book says, inconspicuous consumption, not something extravagant right. and luxurious, but just simple and tiny and everyday, when you actually mm-hmm. break it down, is none of right. those things. And at that point, it starts to seem very overwhelming. If there is nothing that is simple yeah. and easy, I mean, how do you handle this knowledge and understanding that none of this is simple and easy and cost-free, that it all comes with a price tag that's not just economic, it's also an environmental footprint?
Right. I think I was so interested to learn about all of this, as you're saying, these kind of different impacts and these different backstories of all of these things that we take for granted or just assume to be sort of ordinary. And that was one of the things I wanted to communicate in this book, was that, you know, all of these problems, they seem scary and alarming, and they are, but it's also really interesting, and kind of understanding how all these systems work will hopefully make some people feel like they want to do something to change that, or to question these systems in the first place. I think about these things like, you know, trying to use less plastic, or, you know, not eating meat, or if I have to fly, offsetting my flight and things like that. And that's more because I feel like I want to live in line with my values more than I think that individual action solves this problem. And that's not to say that individual action isn't important, but these problems are so big and complicated and connect people all over the world, that, you know, we need kind of bigger systemic changes from governments and corporations. And that's something that I've tried to get across in the book.
Tatiana Schlossberg's new book is Inconspicuous Consumption. She'll be talking about it at the Martha's Vineyard Book Festival, and the book will be out in late August. Tatiana, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Einstein's theory of general relativity was revolutionary when it was introduced. Over the past century, aspects of the theory have been proven in experiment after experiment, and much of it has become an assumed underpinning of daily life, even for non-scientists. Like Einstein's description of gravity. Gravity is gravity, right? How strong it is depends on the mass of the objects involved. Or maybe not. Scientists have been struggling to account for the majority of mass and energy in the universe. Decades of searching have so far failed to turn up a new particle to fill the void of so-called dark matter. And then there's dark energy. Equations tell us that dark matter and dark energy should be there, even if we don't know what they are. But a new theory, called chameleon theory, takes a different approach, starting with the question, what if gravity changes over space and time? Could that account for the mismatch between the matter and energy we know about and the matter and energy we think should be there? Christian Arnold is a physicist at Durham University. He and his colleagues have been developing what they call chameleon theory. Christian, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Give us the basics. I mean, chameleon theory, we all know chameleons change their colors to match their backgrounds. What does that mean in the context of a chameleon theory of gravity?
In Einstein's general relativity, gravity works the same no matter where I am, no matter if I am in a galaxy, in our solar system, or somewhere very far out in space. In chameleon theories, this is different. Chameleon theories change their behavior and the strength of gravity depending what the environment is. So if you are in a galaxy, chameleon theories act basically the same as general relativity and reproduce the successes of GR within the solar system or a galaxy. But if you move far out in space in empty fields, gravity gets stronger in chameleon theories, and with that can explain certain aspects of dark energy.
So does that mean gravity changes over time?
So in chameleon theories, the strength of gravity changes both over time and within space. So if you're in a very underdense region, so say a cosmic void, the forces in chameleon theory are slightly stronger compared to GR. Well, if you are in a galaxy or in the solar system, the forces in chameleon theory are just the same as in GR. So in this way, the theory changes its behavior, its color, like a chameleon.
Where did this idea of gravity changing through space and time originate?
Well, as you already said, Einstein's general relativity is extremely successful in explaining the interactions of big objects in space, say, of planets and the sun in the solar system, or of solar systems in our galaxy in the Milky Way. But general relativity cannot provide a natural explanation of dark energy, which is the mysterious substance which drives the accelerated expansion of our universe. And this lack of an explanation for dark energy motivated scientists to look at alternative gravity theories, and one of these is these chameleon-type modified gravity theories.
Christian Arnold, you and your colleagues at Durham University recently tested this chameleon theory of gravity by running supercomputer simulations of how the Milky Way, our galaxy, formed. How does that actually work as an experiment to test this idea?
Well, what we already knew before was that chameleon theory can reproduce the success of GR within the solar system. What we didn't know was if realistic galaxies can form in this theory. So what we did is we ran, as you said, big supercomputer simulations of the evolution of our universe in this theory to test if realistic galaxies can form. And what we found was that galaxies like our Milky Way, so spiral galaxies with spiral arms and a disk-like shape in the stellar structure, can actually form also in this modified gravity theory.
That means that chameleon theory can work. Does it mean that it is a better explanation? Does that mean that Einstein's theory of general relativity is wrong? Or how much more evidence would you need to start getting to an answer like that?
At the moment, we can definitely not say that Einstein's general relativity is wrong. We can only say that chameleon theories and Einstein's general relativity work equally well to form realistic galaxies.
You've referred to chameleon theory as a way of describing what's going on in the universe and said that there are a lot of things about the mechanisms of how our universe works, very fundamental things that we don't understand, like dark energy and dark matter. Do we have any understanding, or can we postulate any ideas for how and why gravity would change through space and time, why it wouldn't be constant?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there's no reason to assume that it should be the same everywhere. We know that it is the same everywhere on Earth and everywhere within our solar system and within our galaxy. But who tells us whether it is the same on very large scales? We don't have these tests yet. It's the easiest assumption to make, but it's not grounded.
Well, Christian Arnold, on that note, I mean, at this point, general relativity, and for that matter, most of Einstein's work, has come to be the status quo. And anything that challenges that seems really big? I mean, what does it feel like to be a researcher kind of putting your work up there next to Einstein's and saying, yeah, well, maybe it wasn't perfect and maybe we've actually got something better than Einstein had?
Well, I'm not saying we've got something better than Einstein had. And it's very well possible that we find out in a couple of years that our theory is actually wrong and Einstein's works much better. But I think as a physicist, you have to constantly keep challenging theories and ideas and think in new ways. Otherwise, you won't make any progress.
And does this feel to you potentially momentous, like major progress could be made with this new theory?
I think that's very hard to say at the moment. I personally do not believe that a certain theory is a potentially good candidate to be better than GR. GR is very appealing, it's very elegant, it works very well, though we still have to challenge it and to ask a question, is it the right theory? So I think stopping to ask because Einstein's theory is so nice would be the wrong thing.
Christian Arnold is a physicist at Durham University working on a new theory of gravity called chameleon theory. Christian, thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Up next, meet the billionaire who's treating scientists like celebrities. Living Lab Radio continues after the break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. You probably wouldn't be surprised to hear that a California billionaire had thrown an extravagant party for friends that included a custom ice sculpture that funneled high-end whiskey into guests' glasses. But what if I told you the guests were largely scientists and the party was to celebrate a Nobel Prize? One billionaire is pouring money into not only funding research, but also giving scientists celebrity treatment. That billionaire is Sean Parker. He was a co-founder of Napster, if you can remember that far back, and he spent a brief stint as Facebook's first president. Forbes estimates his worth at $2.7 billion. Rebecca Robbins is San Francisco correspondent for the website Stat, and she recently profiled Parker and his unorthodox investments in science. She joins me now. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Stat is a news website focused on, you know, the biomedical industry and biomedical research. What makes Sean Parker a story, not just kind of a curiosity?
Sean Parker is a pretty fascinating figure in this world because I think there have been many billionaires who have made donations, made investments in the space in the past. But Sean Parker, according to people I've spoken with, has made perhaps the most sustained and most serious investment in the space. He committed $250 million to fund cancer immunotherapy research back in 2016. And since then, he's committed hundreds of millions of dollars of his own money in addition to that. And so we wanted to find out, how serious is Sean Parker about this? And in what ways are his investments changing the way that research is being done in the field?
Talk about those investments, and in particular, this area of research that he has focused in on, cancer immunotherapy. I mean, this is kind of one of the holy grails of cancer research, to find ways to activate our own immune systems to fight cancer. 2016 till now, 3 years is not a long time to look for scientific breakthroughs. But is there evidence that his funding is really advancing the research in this area?
Yeah, so cancer immunotherapy, which involves developing treatments that harness the immune system to try to fight cancer, is one of the most exciting fields in medicine right now. It has no shortage of funding. In the past, when Sean Parker was first laying the groundwork for his institute, I think the situation was much less well-funded. I think the consensus has shifted quite a bit so that now cancer immunotherapy has become kind of one of the easiest fields to get funding. But I think amid all this investment, Sean Parker's Institute has tried to focus on funding the most risky, high reward, impactful research. And according to a number of scientists and outside experts in the field, they are making progress in that direction. They recently published their first data on a trial in patients with pancreatic cancer. And so I think they are beginning to generate results. That said, it's still early. We certainly have not generated any Sean Parker funded treatments that are going to be hitting the market anytime soon. But I do think that in a field that is often blocked by many obstacles, Sean Parker's investments do seem to be making an impact, and people welcome the investments that he's made.
You referred to his investments as some of the most serious and sustained investments of celebrities in scientific research. $250 million is a lot of money, and yet in biomedical research, maybe not a huge amount of money. This is expensive research. How large is the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy? How many researchers are we talking about? How many projects is his funding supporting right now?
The money point you make is a good one, because plenty of biotech companies can bring in that amount of money in a single funding round. The National Institutes of Health invests on order of magnitude much more money into the field. But I do think that, according to scientists I've spoken with for this story, these investments are sort of being aimed at collaborations that might not have happened otherwise, combining drugs from different academics or different companies that might not have been otherwise tested together. So the Parker Institute has 60-some staffers in-house, but what they're really doing is trying to convene researchers from some of the top academic institutions across the country. So we're talking some of the biggest names in the field, researchers like Nobel Prize winner Jim Allison at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. And if it sounds like, oh, well, they're just funding some of the usual suspects, that is perhaps a fair critique, but I think there's a sense that they're allowing the usual suspects to do research that they might not have otherwise been able to get funding for.
Well, Rebecca Robbins, in addition to funding the research, you've written for Stat that Sean Parker is also treating these scientists like celebrities. Give us some examples of how Sean Parker is treating scientists differently than perhaps other philanthropic science investors have.
Sean Parker is this celebrity of the worlds of Silicon Valley, of the world of Hollywood. And so over the years, Sean Parker has kind of exposed some of these scientists who are much more at home in a lab than on a red carpet to the good life. So when Sean Parker announced his institute and his investment back in 2016, he threw a big party in his backyard. He lives in the Holmby Hills neighborhood of LA in a home that's sort of a pinnacle of mid-century modern architecture. And that party featured performances from the likes of John Legend, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Lady Gaga. In fact, this was actually the occasion at which Bradley Cooper saw Lady Gaga sang La Vie en Rose, and ultimately that led to him casting her in the film A Star is Born. And so scientists were, of course, in the mix at all of that. And many of the scientists I spoke with talked about sort of the ways in which they have entered into Sean Parker's world and been exposed to this world of glamour. But it also goes both ways, which is that Sean Parker's friends, who are sort of Hollywood, of Silicon Valley, are being exposed to these leading scientists, being exposed to ideas about what's on the cutting edge of cancer immunotherapy. And I think that kind of connection, that bridge between these two worlds, is an important one when leading figures in Silicon Valley and Hollywood shape and influence what kind of ideas get attention.
In your reporting, Rebecca Robbins, have you gotten a sense of why Sean Parker is doing this? Is that interaction a deliberate outcome, or is he just doing this because that's his lifestyle and he's, you know, just bringing another aspect of his life into, you know, the parties that he's throwing as well?
Yeah. So when I asked Sean Parker about this, he really chafed at the idea that he was bringing glamour to the field. You know, he wants to be taken seriously as, you know, a real scholar of this field. And I think he certainly has done his homework, can speak the language of cancer biology fluently. What he says he's trying to do with treating scientists well is to sort of celebrate the people that are really making an impact in the world, and try to align society's values with the work that the scientists are doing, that the innovators are doing, rather than sort of the less impactful things that are often celebrated, like social media influencers, which is a bit ironic given that Sean Parker was Facebook's first president.
I mean, at the same time, I've often heard scientists essentially lament that, you know, that actors and athletes get celebrity status while scientists get, I don't know, nerdy stereotypes. And, you know, if you study climate change, maybe you're even getting hate mail and being vilified, certainly not respected and given celebrity status. But how are these scientists responding now that they are being exposed to that kind of treatment?
Yeah, so I think scientists do recognize that kind of being well known among the public, having their work seen as cool can bring a lot of advantages. That can mean funding, that can mean more attention from policymakers, from people who can sort of set the agenda, but it can also inspire young people to want to go into their field. So I think many scientists I've spoken with do absolutely see a benefit.
Any sense from any of these scientists that they might be able to let go of that more serious big picture, are we benefiting all of science, and just enjoy the good life and feel like, hey, we deserve this. We're doing important things. Why not?
Yeah, no, I think there's certainly a sense that these scientists are enjoying themselves and taking advantage of, I think, some of the resources that Parker can bring to this field. So for instance, Sean Parker's Institute puts on twice a year retreats for these scientists in resort destinations. And, you know, don't get me wrong, the agenda is packed with discussion of collaboration, of ideas that these scientists want to pursue. In fact, that work actually led to the clinical trial, the first one that was read out from the Parker Institute's funding this past spring. So these are absolutely constructive and productive meetings. But at the same time, these scientists are certainly enjoying themselves along with getting important work done.
Any sense that if Sean Parker and his research investments are around for the long term, that he could be a trendsetter more broadly in how scientists are treated by funders and looked at by the broader public?
Sean Parker's deep investment in this field is interesting and unusual for a few reasons. One is that in general, when a celebrity gets involved in a given disease area, it's because they have a personal connection to it. Maybe they were diagnosed themselves with the disease, or maybe they have a close family member who was diagnosed. That's not quite the case for Sean Parker. He does have autoimmune issues. He has allergies and asthma, which is certainly related to the immune system, but he doesn't have a close connection to cancer within his family. And yet he has doubled down on cancer immunotherapy research. He has identified this as sort of the most important thing that he thinks he can help advance. And so I think this model of, you know, not just writing a check and sort of moving on to the next thing, but really staying deeply involved, acting as sort of a venture capitalist and making decisions within the auspices of an institute like this is something we haven't seen before. And it'll be fascinating to see if other philanthropists watch what Sean Parker is doing here and try to adapt it in other disease states.
Rebecca Robbins covers the life sciences industry in the Bay Area for the website Stat, and she's been writing about billionaire Sean Parker's unorthodox approach to science philanthropy. Rebecca, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.